during the nights of his illness that he thought about his life, about what he would do with it once he was released. He couldn't think of anything he wanted more than to leave Cameroon, move to a country where decent young men weren't thrown into prison for minor crimes, but were instead given opportunities to make something of their lives. When he finally got out of prison, after his father had given Nani's father enough money to cover Nani's maternity bills and the child's expenses for the first year of life, and after Pa Jonga had promised that Jende would stay away from Nani indefinitely, Jende returned to Limbe, determined to start saving money to leave the country. He got a job at the Limbe Urban Council, thanks to his friend Bosco, who worked there, and began putting away as much as he could every month for a future with Nani. For a year after his release, though, Nani wanted little to do with him. First, because of her father's threat to kick her out if she continued wasting her life on Jende, and later, because of her grief over the dead baby. Jende finally won her back, thanks to his bi-monthly hand-delivered love letters splattered with words like indefatigable and pulchritudinous. But his dreams of a life for them in America always seemed farther than the nearest star when he compared his savings to the cost of an airline ticket. It was only thanks to Winston's job as a Wall Street lawyer, more than a decade later, that he was able to get the funds to journey to America to start a new life. Liberating as it was, though, the new life had come with its share of new pains. It had wrought new forms of helplessness he hadn't considered, like the dread and despair he'd experienced when Nani and Leomi were both in the hospital after the bus accident. Although their injuries were not critical, a black eye and swollen face for Leomi, a sprained neck and broken wrist plus cuts and bruises for Nani, he couldn't stop thinking that he might have gotten a different kind of call from Nani's sister. A call not to inform him of their injuries and ask for money for their hospital bills, but to tell him that they were dead and ask for money for their funeral expenses. The thought of them dying while he was stuck in America had turned his blood icy. So as often as he could, he had told himself to think of good things and good things only. Which was what he was now doing in the car with his eyes closed. He thought about Mr. and Mrs. Edwards reconciling and being happy again. The way Vince had told him they were back when they lived in Alexandria, Virginia, before his father began working 80 hours a week at Lehman and traveling 4-5 times a month, and before his mother stopped smiling as much as she used to, except when she was with her sons or her friends, or when she was at an event where she felt compelled to pretend to the world that she was a happy woman in a happy marriage. Jende was not sure the Edwards' marriage would ever return to those happy days long gone, when there was less money and more togetherness, and Vince was an only child. But that was okay, because some marriages did not need to be happy. They needed only to be sufficiently comfortable, and he hoped the Edwardses would at least find that. He thought of Vince in India and wished him success in his pursuit of truth and oneness. He hoped the family would be together again one day, and he would continue driving them for years. He loved his job, and if God willed, he would be happy to do it for as long as he lived in New York. There were hard days, but Mr. Edwards was a good man, the boys were good boys, and Mrs. Edwards, even when she acted as if the whole world had let her down, was a good woman. His phone rang as he was opening his eyes. He looked at his caller ID. It was Mr. Edwards. He smiled. He had just thought of him, and now he was calling. That meant Mr. Edwards was going to live a long life. "How was your Christmas?" Clark asked him.
"Very good, sir. I hope you had a good one too, sir."
"Good enough," Clark said. He paused, then cleared his throat. "Are you waiting for Mighty?"
"Yes, sir."
"Right. Listen, do me a favor, will you? After you've dropped off Mighty, can you come down to the office?"
"You are at the office now, sir?"
"Yeah, just got in. I took a cab. I didn't want to take you away from Mighty."
"I understand, sir. I will come down the moment I drop Mighty at home."
"Good. Great. And can you park the car and come upstairs? We need to talk.
Chapter 38.
He found himself in Midtown not knowing how he got there. He might have run a couple of red lights without realizing, changed lanes without signaling, stayed too close to the car ahead of him. He might have driven on the curb and he wouldn't have noticed, because he certainly didn't notice any of the thousands of people on Broadway. He was that dazed. When he got to the garage, he pulled out his briefcase from beneath his seat and held it on his lap for a full minute. Owning the briefcase and carrying it every day to work, that was one of his greatest career prides. It made him feel accomplished, like he was a sort of big man himself, not just a little man driving a big man around. 2 months after he began working for the Edwardses, he had gone shopping for the perfect briefcase and found this one in a store on the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. A black, faux-leather rectangular box with a nickel-plated handle. It looked like the ones the white-collar workers at Limbe Urban Council used to take to work, the ones he'd admired as their bearers strode into offices while he remained outside, cleaning streets and emptying garbage cans. With his own briefcase, he'd become a white-collar professional, too. Every morning, before leaving for work, he packed his lunch inside the box, next to his dictionary, a map of the city, a handkerchief, a pack of tissues, pens, and old newspaper and magazine articles he hoped to read. On the downtown subway, dressed in his suit and clip-on tie, he held it firmly, looking no different from the accountants and engineers and financial advisors sitting next to him. He placed the briefcase on the passenger seat and opened the glove compartment. It was better he remove everything he owned from the car, he told himself. He wasn't being fearful or pessimistic. It was just better a man be prepared for a meeting that could go either way. Mr. Edwards probably just wanted to talk, tell him something he needed to start doing or stop doing. The meeting was most certainly going to end with him smiling, chiding himself for sweating even before he got out of the car. But what if it didn't end happily? Of course it was going to end happily. It was probably going to, most likely going to. But it was best he took out everything he owned and tidied up the car. He searched in the glove compartment, but there was nothing of his in it. Nothing he'd tossed in there and forgotten to take out. He'd always been diligent about that, keeping everything he owned, even his garbage, in his briefcase. Even though he spent hours a day in the car, practically lived in it all day, he was constantly aware that it wasn't his car, and it would never be. He turned around and checked the back seat. It was impeccable, as were the mats, thanks to his visit to a car wash just before Christmas. If he had to leave, he would leave everything in a good condition. But he wasn't leaving. He was just going to have a talk with Mr. Edwards about something. A simple talk. Nothing more. He put on his gloves and hat, picked up the briefcase, and stepped out of the car. For the first time in his life, he was grateful for winter, for its breath, which was taking away the sweat on his brow. He felt refreshed by the light wind blowing south as he walked toward Barclays in the early evening's darkness, going past men in suits, some with briefcases, some with messenger bags, some with no bags, probably because they'd left them at their desks, certain of their return to work the next day. In the Barclays lobby, the guard, perhaps ready to leave and start an early celebration of the coming New Year, distractedly nodded when Jende said hello and did not ask for his ID. He misspelled Jende's name and handed him a visitor pass without glancing at him, his attention on the woman he was chatting and laughing with, a female security guard who was swearing that 2009 would be her year, the year she finally got herself a real good man. In the elevator, he stood next to two men talking about their year-end bonuses. Mr. Edwards had mentioned a raise, but he'd said nothing about a bonus. Could that be what he wanted to talk about? That would be very kind of Mr. Edwards, but he didn't think he needed a bonus on top of a good salary, a raise, and good treatment. If Mr. Edwards offered him a bonus, he would have to do that thing American people do when they want something but are somewhat embarrassed to take it. He would protest lightly, saying, "Oh, no, sir. You don't have to. Really, sir, it's not necessary. You really don't need to, sir." And then he'd take the money. "Good evening, sir," he said as the receptionist closed the door behind him. Clark was sitting at his desk, writing on a legal pad. He lifted his head, smiled, and without words motioned for Jende to have a seat. He continued writing. Jende sat down and told himself to breathe, because breathe was all he could do. If there were lights sparkling outside the window adjacent to Clark's desk, he did not see them. If there were any paintings on the wall, anything worthwhile about this new office, he didn't notice. The only thing he noticed was his breath and his heart beating like the drums he used to play in his boyhood, when the moon was full and children danced in the streets of Newtown till midnight. Clark put aside his writing pad, looked up at Jende, and clasped his hands together on the desk. "I hope you know, Jende," he began, "that I think very highly of you."
"Thank you, sir."
"You've been by far my favorite chauffeur. There really isn't any comparison, by any stretch of the imagination. You're hardworking, you're respectful, you're a good guy to be around. It's been really great."
"Please say what you want to say quickly before I die," Jende pleaded inwardly,
even as he nodded, managed a half-smile, and said,
"I am so glad you like my work, sir."
Clark ran his fingers through his hair. He exhaled, shook his head, and rubbed his eyes. For a moment, Jende wasn't sure what the man wanted to say. Was he sick and wanted him to know what it would be like working for a sick man? Was he moving and wanted Jende to move with him? It seemed as if the discussion was going to be about him, not Jende. But then Clark looked at him, and Jende could see it in his eyes.
"I'm really sorry, Jende," he said, "but I'm going to have to let you go."
Jende bowed his head. So this was happening to him.
It was happening.
"I'm really sorry," Clark said again. Jende kept his head bowed. He had been prepared for it, and yet unprepared. 100 different emotions overcame him, but he wasn't sure which to surrender to.
"I know it's a horrible time for something like this to happen. With the new baby."
"Why, sir?" he asked, looking up.
"Why?"
"Yes, sir," he said.
"I want to know why."
He couldn't control himself. Anger had defeated the other 99 emotions, and there was no use trying to contain it. The sweat on his palms was no longer of fear, but of fury.
"Tell me why, sir," he repeated.
It's complicated."
"Is it Mrs. Edwards, sir?"
Clark did not respond. He looked away to avoid Jende's eyes.
"Is it because of Mrs. Edwards?"
Jende asked again. His voice was loud. He couldn't keep it down.
"There's just too much going on now, Jende. I'm really sorry. I'm trying to do the best I can. I really am, but apparently it's not good enough, and it's all getting to be a bit too much."
"You still have not told me if it's Mrs. Edwards, sir."
"I'm just... it's very complicated."
"Don't lie to me, sir. It's her,"
Jende said, standing up and pushing his chair back. He picked up his briefcase from the floor and slammed it on the table so hard Clark jerked backward.
"It's the book, sir,"
he said as he flipped open the briefcase and pulled out the blue notebook. He flung the briefcase back on the floor and held the book up in his hand, glaring at Clark as he shook the book vigorously.
"It's this stupid book, isn't it, Mr. Edwards?"
he shouted, his voice pained, angry, defeated, betrayed.
"You told me what to write for her, and I wrote it. I wrote only what you told me to write. That's what I did, sir. So please, tell me, sir. It is this book, isn't it, Mr. Edwards?"
Clark did not reply. He did not ask Jende to lower his voice. He covered his face with his hands, rubbed his eyes again.
"I only did what you told me to do, sir. I do this for you, Mr. Edwards. But she doesn't like it because she believes something else. Is that not so, sir? She thinks I am a liar. She thinks I am a liar, right, sir? But I am not a liar. I swear by my grandfather that I would never do anything to cause trouble in another man's house. What I did so you will not have any trouble. And now you will punish me, sir? You will punish me and make my children suffer for doing what you told me to do?"
"I'm so sorry."
"Don't be sorry for me.
Jende cried, slamming the book on the desk.
I don't want sorry. I want a job. I need this job, Mr. Edwards. Please, don't do this to me. Please, I'm begging you, Mr. Edwards, for the sake of my wife and my children and my parents. For the sake of me and my family, please. Please, sir, I'm begging you, don't do this to me.
He sat down, sweating and panting. His handkerchief was in his briefcase, but there was no use pulling it out to wipe his sweat. Clark opened a drawer in his desk, took out a check, and handed it to him. Your paycheck for the rest of the week, he said. Plus more. Jende took the check without looking at him, folded it without looking at the check. He got out of his seat and stooped by his briefcase, picked up his lunch container and his dictionary, which had fallen out when he threw the briefcase on the floor. After slipping the check into the dictionary, he stood up, adjusted his suit, and lifted his briefcase. Clark Edwards stood up too and offered him a hand. Thank you for everything, Jende, Clark said, shaking Jende's weak hand. Good night, sir. Chapter 39. Rejoicing with others in their times of joy and your times of sorrow is a mark of true love, Natasha preached at Judson. It shows an ability to subjugate the ego and view oneself not as a separate entity, but as a vital piece of the divine oneness. Nenny wanted to tell Jende about Natasha's message when she returned home from church. She wanted to say that in spite of their circumstances, they should be happy, because there was so much happiness in the world, and because all of humanity was one. She wanted to say all this and more, but couldn't, because she wasn't sure if she believed it. She was hopeless, and there was nothing anyone else's happiness could do about it. The Jende who had returned home to her on the night of his firing was a husband pitilessly bowed by life. She had suspected something was wrong that night, but she did not deem it right to push an exhausted man to talk, so she let him be. He went to bed without eating, saying nothing to her except that he'd had a bad day and was very tired. I won't be working for Mr. Edwards anymore, he told her at 5 o'clock the next morning, when she woke up to feed Timba. What happened, she wanted to know. Oh, God, what happened? How were they going to manage? How could this be happening now, with the court date only a couple of months away? Nothing happened, he told her. Mr. Edwards is a good man and has been very happy with his service. He just did not need him anymore. But why? He didn't say why. He just thanked me and said he won't be needing me anymore.
Oh, Papa God, why? Oh, Papa God, why?
They would survive, he assured her. Mr. Edwards had given him a nice goodbye check, which was equal to 2 months' salary. By the time the money ran out, he should be back driving a cab in the Bronx. He only had to call Mr. Jones and get his old job back.
Have we not come this far?
He asked her, holding her by the shoulders and looking into her eyes.
If someone had told us back when we were in Limbe, and I was collecting garbage, that we would be in New York City, would we have believed it?
She shook her head and closed her eyes to release her tears. Timba was cooing on the bed next to them, still living in a perfect world.
It's Mrs. Edwards, she said. It doesn't matter, baby. It's her.
Come, he said, drawing her to his chest. Chapter 40. Mr. Jones, the owner of the livery cabs, had no shift for him.
People are lining up around the block to drive a cab, he said. Too many people. Don't even got enough cars to rent to everyone.
Not even graveyard shift, Jende asked. I'll take anything.
I only got 5 cars. 5 cars and 14 people who want to drive them.
Jende tried to coax him into taking shifts from other drivers to give to him.
But I used to take good care of the car, Mr. Jones, remember? No accidents, no scratches.
Sorry, bro. Ain't no more shifts. Nothing for the next 2 months. I'll call you if someone calls to cancel. Promise. Keep you on standby.
Nani came into the bedroom as he was ending the call. His head hung so low it seemed in danger of falling off. She sat beside him on the bed. We still have a good amount of money saved, she said, placing her hand on his lap.
So what?
So, let's not worry too much, eh?
Yes, he said, standing up. Let's not worry until all the money is gone.
He went into the living room, sat on the sofa, and turned on the TV. Less than a minute later, he turned it off. He couldn't watch. To be sitting at home jobless seemed the worst punishment of all. The idleness. The worthlessness. Watching television when others were at work felt completely profane. It was what little children and old people and sick people did, not able men. You want me to make you some fried ripe plantains and eggs? Nani whispered, stooping beside him with her hands on his knees. She was trying too hard, he could tell. It wasn't for her to save him. He had to save himself.
No, he said, standing up and walking toward the door. I need some air.
The next week, after a series of long, restless nights, he got a job washing dishes at two restaurants. One of the restaurants he used to work for when he first came to New York, back before he got a driver's license and started driving a cab. On his first day back, a colleague told him about an opening at another restaurant in Hell's Kitchen. He took the subway there right after his shift and got that job, too. With the two jobs, he worked mornings, afternoons, evenings. He worked weekends, too. For 6 days of the week, he left before Leomi woke up and came back after he was in bed. For working all those hours, he got less than half of what he used to make working for Clark Edwards. Better this than to be like all those people with no jobs in this bad economy, he consoled himself. Still, it was an undignified fall. To be wearing a suit and holding a briefcase every day, driving to important places, eavesdropping on important conversations, only to now find himself scraping leftovers from plates and loading them into a dishwasher. To once have driven Alexis to executive meetings, only to now stand in a corner cleaning silverware. To once have had hours of free time to sit in the car and catch up on his phone calls, call Nenny to check on her day, call his parents to check on their health, call his friends back in Limbe for the latest news, only to now have a mere 15 minutes here and there to sit and rest his hands or have a free meal from the kitchen. 3 weeks into the jobs, his feet began to ache. Maybe it's arthritis, Nenny suggested, since his father had the same condition. Pajonga's fingers and toes had curled up and out from the disease, and Jende always feared it was inheritable. You have to go see a doctor, she said after he had spent a whole night groaning, unable to fall asleep. He agreed, but where was he going to find the time, he asked her. Besides, he didn't think it could be arthritis. He was not yet 40. He was young and strong. The pain would go away. A bit of massaging after work would be good enough. So she rubbed them with coconut oil and bound them up every night. In the morning they felt better, ready for 12 or more hours of dishwashing. She begged him to let her go back to work. She could call the agency and get another home health aid job really fast. Two incomes would be better than one at a time like this, she argued. He said no, he wanted her home. She was his wife, he would take care of her. He couldn't imagine her leaving a newborn in a daycare they could barely afford and running off to work all day only to return home tired, overwhelmed, and guilt-ridden. And then, no matter how exhausted she was, she'd still have to cater to an infant, a boy, and a grown man. It was his responsibility to protect her from such a life. If he couldn't, then he wasn't fulfilling his duty, which was how he felt on the nights he returned home to find her worried because the baby was running out of diapers and Leomi needed a new pair of shoes and there wasn't enough money to buy beef so she could cook rice and beef stew. Whenever he saw her anxiety, he was tempted to take out some of the money from their savings, but he resisted. They would manage with the little he was making at the restaurants, She had to return to school in the fall. His deportation case wasn't over. The worst might still be ahead. On the day of his court appearance, he wore the black suit he had worn to work on his first day working for the Edwardses. Nenny had washed and ironed it the night before, neatly placing it on the sofa for him to wear in the morning. Neither of them ate dinner that night, their appetites having been vanquished by their fears. He stayed on the phone talking to Winston, while she sat at the computer reading stories about individuals who lost their deportation cases, and families who found themselves straddling two countries because one of the parents had been deported. "Whatever happens, we will take it as it comes," he told her before they went to bed, and she nodded in agreement, her eyes filling up with tears.
"You are sleeping,"
he whispered to her in the middle of the night.
"No, I can't sleep." "What are we going to do?"
he asked her, his voice plaintive, clearly desperate to be reminded that they would be okay.
"I don't know what we are going to do. I don't even know."
They couldn't move close to each other and fall asleep in a comforting embrace. The baby was sleeping between them, so they held hands around the baby. In the morning, he stood next to Boubacar as the lawyer answered most of the judge's questions, speaking in an unquestionable American accent. Boubacar and the judge and the attorney for ICE took turns saying things Jende did not understand. The judge set a date in June for Jende to appear before him again. Boubacar thanked the judge. The judge called for the next case. The whole exchange had lasted less than 10 minutes.
"You see what I told you,"
Boubacar said, grinning as they exited the federal building.
"I continue doing this, and we continue buying you time. For now, you're a free man."
Jende nodded, though he didn't feel free. It seemed to him a rather pathetic way of being, postponing the inevitable. He would much rather be truly free.
Chapter 41. She sat on the crosstown bus with the gift bag on her lap, watching as shoppers entered and exited clothing stores and corner bodegas, electronics stores and jewelry boutiques, beauty supply stores and fast food joints. Traffic on 125th Street was slow. The M60 bus was moving and stopping every quarter minute, but she remained calm, listening as two men behind her chatted about the Obama inauguration.
"I wouldn't have missed it for nothing," the first man said.
"My son says to me, 'I ain't coming to stand for hours and no cold,'" the second man said.
"Cold? Can you believe these children? A historic moment,
and you're going to be talking nonsense about no cold weather?"
The first man chuckled.
"I got bumps all over me still,
thinking about when that pastor came up to say prayers, talking about the miracle, how such a day could even be possible in our lifetime.
In my mama's lifetime. You know, whatever happens from here, it almost don't matter."
"No, don't suppose it does."
"'Cause somewhere up there, Dr. King is looking down at Brother Barack and saying, 'That's my boy.'"
"That's right. Our boy did it."
At Lexington, she got off the bus and took the 5 subway downtown. Again, she held the gift bag on her lap, her grip on its handle tight. When she got off at the 77th Street stop, she checked the Edwards' address and began walking toward Park Avenue. She had never been in this part of town and was awed by its elegance. Streets with no dirt, doormen dressed like rich men, a woman in 6-inch Louboutin heels strutting as if the world should be hers on a diamond-encrusted platter. Everything so close to Harlem and yet 10,000 miles away from Harlem.
"Can I help you?" the doorman at the Sapphire said to her, not moving away from the fiberglass door.
"I am here to see Mrs. Edwards, please," she said.
"She's expecting you."
Nenny nodded, hoping the absence of words would hide her deception.
"Service entrance,"
the man said, motioning toward the garage on the right. Her heart pumped faster than usual as she walked down the dim-lighted hall to apartment 25A. What if Mrs. Edwards wasn't home, she thought. What if Anna changed her mind and refused to let her in? Anna had told her that Mrs. Edwards might be in the master bedroom and not want to be disturbed, but Nenny could stop by, try her luck.
You lucky?
Anna whispered as she opened the door.
She just came back out to living room.
Nenny took off her shoes in the foyer and followed Anna into the kitchen.
What you want to see her for?
Anna asked, looking at Nenny curiously.
I just want to give her a gift. I give it to her for you,
Anna said, extending her hand.
No, I want to give it to her myself,
Nenny said, putting the bag behind her back. She couldn't share her plan with Anna. Anna would definitely try to discourage her. Anna had called 2 days after Jende lost his job to say how sorry she was and how much she feared she would be next, because Cindy was acting like a madwoman these days, barely eating, rarely going out, stumbling around the apartment some mornings with puffy, bloodshot eyes. And Anna couldn't tell Clark anything about the alcohol now, because if Cindy suspected she was talking about her, all the years she'd worked for the family would mean nothing. Now, Anna said, she was secretly calling housekeeping agencies to see if she could get a new job, while jumping even higher at every word Cindy uttered, so Cindy wouldn't find any reason to fire her, because she badly needed a job, especially now that her daughter was in college and her oldest son's construction business was failing, and he and his wife and 3 children had moved in with her. Nenny, still discombobulated and uninterested in talking about someone potentially losing a job when her husband had already lost his, had aloofly assured Anna that Cindy wasn't going to fire her after 22 years of service. But Anna had said over and over that you never know. Sometimes people do funny things, so you just never know.
Wait here,
Anna said.
I go see if she wants to see you.
For minutes, Nenny stood alone in the kitchen, looking around at the stainless steel appliances and the cream-colored cabinetry with brass handles. The ultra-clean kitchen island with a bowl of perfect-looking apples and bananas. The black marble table and vase of fresh pink calla lilies. The wolf stove with its frantically loud red buttons. The kitchen was more beautiful than the one in Southampton, which Nenny had been certain couldn't be surpassed in beauty. She wondered if Cindy cooked here often, or if she used it only occasionally, to make a special recipe for the boys, or give detailed directions to the help during party preparations, the way she'd done over the summer.
Go to the living room now,
Anna whispered to her.
Do it quick, and leave.
Nenny stepped into the Edwards's Upper East Side living room for the first time, and for a lengthy second all she saw was the view of Manhattan beyond the window. A panorama of steel and concrete buildings tightly packed like the brick and carabot houses of Newtown Limbe. The room smelled of the softest, sweetest intermingling of baby powder and perfume, and she realized, like Jende had said, that everything in it was white or gray. The large chandelier, white crystals gleaming silvery finish. The floor, glossy marble and gray. The plush carpet, snow white. The sofa and love seat, white. The armchairs, gray with white throws. The textured wall coverings, 4 shades of gray. The glass center table and the silver vases on it. The candlestick standing in the 4 corners of the room, silver. The ottoman, striped gray. The twin wall frames behind the sofa, with line-drawn portraits of a naked woman lying on her back and side, white canvas. And the window curtains and valance, silver.
Anna says you came to give me something, Cindy said.
She did not lift her eyes from the book she was reading.
Yes, madame,
Nenny said.
Good morning, madame.
Cindy stretched out her hand to receive the bag.
It was made by my mother in Cameroon, madame,
Nenny said, handing it over.
I thought you would like it, because you said you liked when I wore the same kind of dress in the Hamptons.
Cindy peered into the bag and put it aside on the floor.
Thank you,
she said.
Tell Jende I say hello.
Nenny stood in the same spot, confounded. She hadn't imagined the meeting would begin and end this way, not considering how much Cindy had seemed to like her in her last days in Southampton, and how well they had parted with a hug, albeit an awkward one, which she'd felt compelled to give the madame, as gratitude for the gifts and bonus money. Cindy had asked about Leomi at the brunch in June's apartment, and told Nenny that she'd be sending him a couple of Mighty's old winter jackets through Jende, which she did 3 days later. But the happy Mrs. Edwards of that Sunday was not the same Mrs. Edwards sitting in her living room that Tuesday. Anna had mentioned that Cindy had lost at least 10 pounds since Clark moved to the hotel the day after Christmas, and Nanny could tell from how gaunt her face looked, even beneath her makeup.
"Anything else?"
Cindy asked, looking up at her.
"Yes. Yes, madame," Nanny said. "I also came to talk to you about something, madame."
"Yes?" Deciding she had to be brave if she was to say what she had come to say, Nanny walked to the sofa and sat down next to Cindy. Cindy's eyes widened at her former housekeeper's audacity, but she said nothing.
"I came here, madame, to see if you can help my husband,"
Nanny said. Her head was tilted. Her eyes narrowed to implore in ways her words couldn't.
"If you could please help my husband, if you could help him get his job back with Mr. Edwards."
Cindy turned her face away and looked toward the window. While the 1,000 different sounds of New York City blended outside, Nanny waited for a response.
"You're funny, you know,"
Cindy said, turning to face Nanny. She was not smiling.
"You're a very funny girl. You're coming to ask me to help your husband?"
Nanny nodded.
"Why? What do you think I can do for him?"
"Anything, madame."
"Your husband lost his job because Clark no longer needs his services.
There's nothing I can do about that."
"But madame,"
Nanny said, her head still tilted, her eyes still beseeching.
"Maybe you can help him get another job. Maybe you know someone, or one of your friends. Maybe they need a chauffeur."
Cindy scoffed.
"What do you think I am?"
she asked.
"An employment agency? Why can't he go out there and get a job like everybody else?"
"It's not that he can't get a job by himself, madame. He found a little something, washing dishes at restaurants, but it is not easy. Too many hours, and his feet hurt every night.
It's so hard out there, madame. Too. Very hard to get a good job now, and it is hard for me and the children, too, with him not having a good job that can take care of us well."
"I'm sorry," Cindy said, picking up her book.
"It's a tough world."
Nanny's throat tightened, and she swallowed hard.
"But back in the Hamptons, madame," she said, "you told me to help you. Remember how I promised you, madame, as woman to woman, as a mother to a mother. I am asking the same from you today. Please, Mrs. Edwards, to help me any way that you can help me."
Cindy continued reading.
"In any way, madame, even if it's a job for me, even if... I'm sorry, okay? I really can't help you. I wish I could, but I can't. Please, madame, if you could leave so I can continue my reading, I'll appreciate it."
But she didn't leave. Nanny Junga wasn't going to leave until she got what she wanted. She turned around, picked up her purse from the floor, and pulled out her cell phone. She opened it, and there, in the picture folder, she found what she was looking for. Her moment had arrived.
"That day, madame,"
she said, her head no longer tilted,
"I took a picture."
Cindy looked up from her book.
"That day in the Hamptons,"
Nanny whispered, moving nearer to Cindy and holding her Motorola razor close to Cindy's face.
"I took this."
Cindy looked at the photo. In an instant, her face turned from gaunt to ghostly as she stared at an image of herself in a stupor. Her mouth half open, drool running down her chin. Her upper body splayed against the headboard, a bottle of pills and a half-empty bottle of wine on the nightstand.
"How dare you?"
Nanny pulled back the phone and closed it.
"You think you can blackmail me? Who do you think you are?" "I'm just a mother like you, madame,"
Nanny said, putting the phone back in her purse.
I'm only trying to do what I have to do for my family.
Get out of my house right now!
Nanny did not move. Cindy stood up and repeated the command. Nanny remained seated and silent.
Is everything okay?
Anna asked, running into the living room with a duster. She was talking to Cindy but looking at Nanny, giving her an angry, what the hell are you doing, look. Nanny ignored her. This had nothing to do with her.
Call 911,
Cindy shouted. Still, Nanny did not budge. She chuckled and shook her head.
Yes,
Anna said, rushing to the kitchen before stopping halfway.
What should I say?
An intruder!
Hurry, get me the phone. You want to learn a lesson? I'll teach you a lesson.
Nanny remained seated.
I googled it all, madame, she said, smirking.
Googled what?
Googled how to do this well. What to say when the police comes. You useless piece of shit. I know what the police will ask me. What I will say? Before the police comes, I will delete the picture. When they come, I will say, I don't know what you are talking about. Police will think you are a crazy woman, and they'll call your husband or your friends. Then you will have to tell them. Is that what you want, Mrs. Edwards?
Anna! Phone!
Anna ran to the living room with the kitchen phone and handed it to Cindy.
Leave us,
Cindy said to Anna, who gave Nanny another dirty look before hurrying out of the living room. Cindy held the phone, looking at it as if punching 911 required a strength she couldn't muster.
Call them,
Nanny said.
Shut up! What are you going to tell them, madame? That I have a picture of you doing drugs and drinking? I'm not afraid. You're the one who should be afraid, because if the police takes me away, everyone is going to know why.
Cindy remained standing, clutching the phone and breathing heavily, her chest rising and falling like that of a woman sprinting up Mount Cameroon.
Call them, madame,
Nanny said again.
Please, call them.
If a glare could kill, dismember, and chop a body into fine bits, Nanny's body would have ended up a trillion little pieces because that was what Cindy's eyes would have done to her. But a glare could do no such thing, and Nanny could see she was halfway to victory. Cindy threw the phone on the sofa and sat down, trembling.
What do you want?
She said to Nanny. Even her cheeks were trembling.
Help, madame. Any kind of help. And you think this is how to get it? This is what you had planned all along when I hired you? To blackmail me? To find a way to hurt my family?
Nanny shook her head.
I never took the picture for this reason, madame. I was afraid that day, and I took the picture so that if something bad had happened to you, I will show the police what you were looking like when I entered the room, and my hands will be clean. I didn't even remember I had the picture till a few days ago when... You must think I'm stupid if you expect me to believe that. Believe it or not, it's the truth, Mrs. Edwards.
Blackmailing.
Blackmailing,
Cindy said, shaking her head and wagging her finger at Nanny.
It's a crime. You'll pay for this.
I'll make you pay for this.
For what seemed like a thousand seconds, the women stared at each other. Brown eyes next to hazel eyes. Round cheeks next to hollow cheeks. Face of determination next to face of defeat. Cindy turned her face away first.
What are you going to do with the picture?
She asked, looking at the skyline outside, panic fully taking over her speech for the first time that afternoon. Nanny shrugged.
I don't yet know, madame,
she said, smirking again.
But a person I met, he works for a website that writes news about people in the Hamptons. He told me they are always looking for good pictures of women like you. You filthy bitch!
Nanny grinned. The lie had worked. This was precisely where she wanted Cindy.
I wish you too a good day, madame,
she said, picking up her purse. She stood up and straightened her red turtleneck.
Sit down,
Cindy ordered.
I'm sorry, madame. I need to go cook dinner for my family. I said sit down.
Nenny sat down.
How much do you want?
Nenny looked Cindy straight in her eyes, let out a short laugh, and said nothing.
I said name your price.
You should know better than me, madame, how much this kind of thing should cost.
Wow,
Cindy said, shaking her head again.
Wow. I'm very disappointed in you, Nenny. I'm appalled and so, so disappointed.
Nenny Djonga would not be fooled again. A courage she never knew she possessed had fully taken root. She shrugged and pulled her purse closer to her chest.
After all Clark and I have done for you and Jende, this is how you repay us?
Nenny turned her face away and fidgeted as if getting ready to stand up again. Cindy stood up, hurried out of the room, and returned a minute later with a check. Without looking at the sum on the check, Nenny shook her head.
Cash, madame,
she said.
I don't keep large amounts of cash at home.
That's not what I heard, madame.
I heard rich people keep a lot of cash in their houses, in case something bad happens to the banks. Don't make assumptions about me based on what you've read.
Nenny scoffed and smiled. She was enjoying this more than she'd thought she would.
Then I'll wait for you to go to the bank, or we can go together.
She saw Cindy's fist clench, and for a second thought the woman was going to break her jawbone, or ask Anna to call 911 again. Instead, Cindy turned around and returned minutes later with a paper bag.
I'm only giving you this,
Cindy said as she handed over the bag,
because of the goodness of my heart. Because I know how badly you need it, and I wouldn't want your children to suffer because of you and your husband's stupidity. But if I ever see you again, I promise you, you will end up in jail. You can choose to believe it or not, but I'll make sure you go to jail, and I won't give a shit. Now hand me the picture, and get the hell out of my house.
Nenny took the SIM card from her cell phone, handed the phone to Cindy, and walked out of the Edwards' apartment. Chapter 42. After she'd put the children to bed, she counted the money in the bathroom, looked at herself in the mirror, and smiled. Nothing like starting the day agonizing over money and ending it triumphant beyond her imagination. She opened the medicine cabinet, took out her red lipstick and applied it, puckered her lips, smiled again, sprayed perfume on her neck, and walked out to the living room where Jende was watching a Nets game.
What is this?
He asked, after she placed the brown paper bag next to him on the sofa.
Guess,
she said.
You went shopping again, eh?
He said, still watching the Nets about to lose. She shook her head and sat down next to him. She couldn't stop smiling. At any other time, she would have been happy to play a guessing game, but she couldn't hold back the good news today. She leaned close to him and whispered in his ear,
It's money.
Eh?
I showed Mrs. Edwards the picture. She gave me $10,000.
You did what?
$10,000, baby.
She started laughing, tickled by the look of shock on his face, by the way his mouth, nose, and eyes had all opened up in disbelief. He did not laugh with her. He opened the bag and peeked into it. He looked at her, and the bag, and her again.
What did you do, Nenny?
He asked for the second time.
$10,000, baby,
she said for the third time, incredulous still at how much Cindy had believed the picture to be worth.
Are you crazy?
Wait! Is that anger on your face?
She couldn't believe him. She'd imagined his reaction wouldn't be one of pure joy, but she hadn't thought it would be this bad. He was looking at her as if she was a thief. As if she had done something disgraceful when she'd just gotten them $10,000.
$10,000 they needed and deserved.
What exactly did you do?
He asked. She told him what she'd said to Cindy Edwards.
How dare you?
He said, pushing her hand away from his knee.
How dare me?
Yes, how dare you? What gives you the right to treat her like that?
I mean, how could you, Nanny?
After everything they did for us.
What about what we did for them?
She said, grabbing the paper bag and standing up.
Were we not good to them, too? Why is it that they and their problems are more important than us and our problems? I kept her secret. And what does she do for me? She has her husband fire you.
You don't know that.
You don't know women like her, Jende. You don't know how they think they are better than people like us. How they think they can do anything they want to people like us.
Mr. Edwards did what he had to do. I don't like what he did to me, but he has every right to do what he needs to do.
Oh, so you think I don't have that right too?
That doesn't mean you should have done something like this to her, he said. We are not those kind of people. How could you even have gone there without asking me first?
Because I know what you would have said.
Yes, I would have said it because I want nothing to do with this kind of wickedness.
Wickedness, sir?
Yes, it's wicked and I don't like it. No one has any right to be wicked to another person.
Oh, so now I'm a wicked person. So you married a wicked woman, didn't you?
He sighed and turned his face away.
Just tell me what you think of me, Jende. You think I'm a wicked woman, eh? Just because I do something to help us, you think
you didn't have to do something like this?
She thought she could use us, stupid African people who don't know how to stand up for themselves. She thinks we are not as smart as she is. She thinks she can...
This has nothing to do with being African.
Yes, it does. People with money, they think their money can do anything in this world. They can hire you when they like, fire you when they like. It means nothing to them.
What are you talking about? That woman was good to us.
So, you don't want the money?
She said, shaking the paper back. He turned off the TV and went into the bathroom. She heard water splashing and figured he was washing his face. He sometimes did that when he didn't know what else to say. She sat down on the sofa, livid and humiliated. How could he see her as one of those kinds of people when all she was doing was trying to help their situation? And now she was wicked? She was a bad person for being a good mother and wife? He returned to the living room and sat down next to her. She turned away from him. I didn't mean to get so angry, he said, moving closer to her.
Don't touch me,
she said.
Let's try and calm down and start the conversation all over again, okay?
I said, don't touch me. Don't even dare touch me right now.
He shifted away from her, and for a few seconds neither of them spoke. I don't like what you did, he said calmly.
If you don't want the money, you don't have to take it,
she said, standing up and jiggling the bag in his face.
I'll open up a bank account and use it for myself only.
Please sit down, Nanny.
Tomorrow morning I'll go to the bank and open a new account and...
He reached forward and pulled the bag from her hands. She lunged at him to take it back, but he dragged her down to the sofa and made her sit next to him. She tried to stand up and get away from him, but he held her down.
I'm sorry, Bebe, he whispered in her ear. I'm so shocked. I mean... I still don't even know what to say.
She scoffed and pursed her lips.
You just did something.
He shook his head.
You surprise me all the time, but you just took it to a whole other level today. In short, I didn't know what kind of woman I married till this night.
Eh, really? What kind of woman is that? A wicked woman, eh?
No. He replied. A strong woman. I never knew you could do the kind of thing you just told me.
She half rolled her eyes.
But please, don't ever do it again. I'm begging you, Bebe. Never, ever again. I don't care why you think you need to do it. Don't ever do it.
You want the money or not?
She said, smiling and enjoying the new look on his face. I don't know. I'm just not comfortable, Nanny.
You're not comfortable.
But 10 kolo in our hands, he said.
So, you're getting happy now, eh?
$10,000. She laughed and kissed him. Together they did a recount of the money, feeling each of the crisp $100 bills. We won't spend any of it, he said to her. We'll add it to the savings and act as if we don't even have it. God forbid worse comes to worse one day. We'll use it then. She nodded. Wonders shall never end, eh? He said.
Wonders shall never end, she said. Not while the sun goes up and down.
But why you not afraid? What if she had called the police? Neni Jonga shrugged, looked at her husband, and smiled.
That's the difference between me and you, she said. You would have been thinking about it too much, wondering whether you should do it or not. Me, I knew it's what I had to do.
Chapter 43. With her grocery budget only 2/3 of what it used to be before Jende stopped working for the Edwardses, shopping at Pathmark became a taxing experience. Nothing like in the days when she first came to America. The times when she used to rush through the store excitedly thinking, Mamma mia, so much food, so many choices, all in one place. The only thing she hated about grocery shopping back then was the prices. They made no sense. 3 plantains for $2? Why? $2 in Cameroon was approximately 1,000 CFA francs. And for that amount, as recently as in the early 2000s, a woman could buy groceries to feed her family 3 good meals. She could buy a pile of cocoyams for 400 CFA francs, smoked fish for 250, vegetables for 100, about 6 ounces of palm oil for 100, crayfish and spices with the rest of the money, go home and make a large pot of potopoto coco that would feed her family of 4 lunch and dinner. And there'd still be a little left over for the children to eat the following morning before going to school. If the woman was smart, she would make the food extra spicy, so the children would have a sip of water with every bite, get full faster, and the food would last longer. It seemed illogical to Neni that the same amount of money in America could buy only 3 plantains, which wasn't enough to feed Jende alone for one day. She hadn't expected the prices in New York to be the same as in Limbe. But she found it difficult not to be bothered whenever she bought a pound of shrimp for the equivalent of 5,000 CFA francs, the monthly rent for a room with a shared outdoor bathroom and toilet for all the residents in a carabot building. You have to stop comparing prices, Jende advised her whenever she brought up the issue. You keep on comparing prices like that, he'd say. You'll never buy anything in America. The best thing to do in this country, whenever you enter a store, is to ignore the exchange rate, ignore the advertisements, ignore what everyone else is eating and drinking and talking about these days, and buy only the things you need. She began doing so, and after perhaps her 10th visit to Pathmark, she stopped thinking about the exchange rate and learned how to plan meals around what was on sale. In those first weeks in New York, she always walked the 13 street blocks north and 3 avenue blocks west to go to the store, pushing her shopping cart with one hand and holding Naomi with the other, both of them wearing matching floral spring jackets Jende had bought before their arrival. They walked leisurely whenever the weather allowed so she could take in as much of Harlem as possible. The brownstones with black railings, satisfied patrons admiring their hairdos in beauty parlors, friendly old men nodding hello, happy Harlemites smiling at her. Jende had warned her to be careful walking northward, because there was talk of gangs and shootings in the housing projects around 145th. But because she never saw anyone with a gun, she walked without worries, going past young and old chatting on street corners. At Pathmark, Even after her first visit, she was impressed with the American way of shopping. The queues at checkout, everyone calmly awaiting their turn, the orderly aisles with